All right, here we are. So, did you have a homework assignment? Do I remember what it was? Did you do it? Anybody? Does anybody have anything to say? I can't remember either. I get loose at myself. Anyway, you were supposed to do something. Did anybody do it? Practice receiving blessings, Nishkama. Thank you. That was the assignment. Does anybody have anything to report? We're so busy, we forget everything, don't we? Okay, let's have a comment.
I think that it's absolutely thrilling to believe and then have an ever-increasing faith that such blessings are constantly coming our way, more and more profusely. It's just overwhelming thought to me.
Yeah.
And it's really nice to get little glimpses and hints of the truth of that. It just helps everything to grow and grow and grow. It's just wonderful.
I think that's very well put.
Yeah.
Okay, any other thoughts or comments? Adam?
There you go. In addition to liking the image of...
Just put it a little closer to your mouth.
Uh-huh. Dumping a bucket of blessings on us.
Oh, that's right. That's where I ended last week.
It
was the coach dumping at the winning... The team dumping it on the coach, right.
I just like to remember the fact that it's not that we're not... having blessings upon us, it's that we're not receiving them inwardly.
Mm-hmm.
And so just to remember that and sort of open that channel again when it's been closed, you know, either subconsciously or just being brought deeper into delusion, that, you know, it's very easy to do.
It's interesting when Swamiji wrote the Festival of Light, which we do every Sunday, he chose from various traditions. You know, he has an ancient prayer from Judaism, and he has a bit from the New Testament and a bit from Bhagavad Gita. He has as many as received him to then get them gave he the power to become the sons of God. And that's the ritual that we do every single Sunday. And sometimes people say, you know, oh, it's boring, we should do something else. You know, there's people who feel that way. The people don't complain much now, but people used to complain. But he wanted something that you could just keep hearing over and over again, and you couldn't, you know, send your mind down new tracks, but you had to just keep listening to the same ideas coming in over and over, because if we could just get that one alone, it would shift everything. So every week we say that, as many as received him. Wow, that's quite a promise. And that's the only condition, that you receive it. Quite something, really. Any other comments or thoughts? Saranya?
Of all of the things that we've tried to practice, for me, being grateful has been something that comes easily, because I really feel tremendously grateful. I feel grateful for this path, for having found Ananda, for, you know, just so many things. And what I've kind of started doing is, even before this, is thanking Divine Mother for all the little tiny things that happen. You know, today I was going to the store and the parking lot was full and I got a spot right away. You know, thank you, Divine Mother. And, you know, it's not that when you don't get a parking spot, you know, what's up? But but just a way to constantly keep, you know, Divine Mother at my side and with all the things. But there was one time, so this week was more of thinking about, oh, the class is supposed to be doing this, you know, remembering that. But there was one time this week, I think, when I was feeling just a little bit down for some reason and thought about being grateful. And I could just feel my heart uplifted just by, you know, saying, no, be grateful, whatever, you know, find something to be grateful for. And I don't even remember what it was, but just had that uplifting feeling. Mm. Yeah.
You know, Swamiji tells the story in The Path about being in a mood and, you know, feeling that Master didn't love him. I think I talked about that story here, about Master didn't love him. And then he shifted his level of consciousness. And as soon as he shifted his level of consciousness, everything else changed. It's a very important thing to remember. We're going to talk about devotion tonight, and that's part of it. Sometimes, you know, you can just think about it till you're blue in the face. It's not going to make any difference, because as long as you're at a certain vibration, you'll only attract thoughts that are consistent with that vibration. And so if you're in a sort of trend of whatever it is, you'll find all the reasons in the world to reinforce it. But if you can shift your vibration, then you will literally perceive a whole different... Your thoughts are not universal, not individual, but universal, and they'll come into you. So a lot of times we think, oh, I have to worry about this, I have to reason about it. But when you just do something that shifts your vibration, then your whole, all your thought forms follow, because reason follows feeling. So whatever the feeling is, you'll have all the reasons in the world for it. There was this one woman, she didn't last at Ananda, but she had very good karma. Swamiji took a real serious interest in her and thought she had a lot of spiritual potential, and he put a lot of energy into trying to help her. And she made the decision that she really didn't like being in his company, because when she was in his company, she couldn't remember her problems. And she was concerned that if she couldn't keep them uppermost in her mind, how would she ever solve them? No amount of effort on the part of many of us dissuaded her. She just, you know, lunatic. But it was sort of like she was comfortable in that vibration, and it unnerved her to be lifted out of that vibration. She really felt she had to stay there. And a lot of our inability to receive blessings is because we like where we are. You know, that's sometimes how I work with, you know, my persistent delusions. If I'm persisting and holding on to something, I just have to admit to myself, I must be getting some pleasure out of this. Because if I wasn't, a friend of mine, I mean, it's a way to help people, but I was having some, it was years ago when I was first working and living here. I was in over my head and I was struggling in various ways, and I expressed to her something about how I was feeling. And in just the most solicitous way, she said, and how's that working for you? But it was interesting to me, because I realized that as long as I held on to that particular distorted view of reality, I could keep just running in a circle in that distortion, and I never actually had to move to a higher level. So it was comfortable. As long as I remained upset and could just have a, you know, remember my problem, then I didn't have to take the next expansive step for myself. And so we often do that. It's very tricky. That's why we're just receiving. Okay, I'm going to be happy. I'm not going to be unhappy now. But it's a level of responsibility. There was a sweet story that Jacqueline, who lived here, told on herself. There was a very difficult man. This was 25 or 30 years ago. And he was a very difficult man, and Jacqueline wrote to Swamiji that, you know, she was having so much trouble with this guy, and he was doing this, and he was doing that, and, you know, she had lots of really valid criticisms. Swami's answer was very short. Oh, he just wants to be your friend. Just love him. He just wants to be your friend. And she said, I don't want to. It was just like, I don't want to. Like Jyotish's son, when he had been, some boy had treated him very unkindly, and he was very hurt by it and mad, and Jyotish, he was about 7, Jyotish let him sort of be hurt and mad, but then later, after he calmed down a little, Jyotish tries to expand his son's point of view. You know, he's unhappy and he was just taking it out on you, and maybe you could be his friend. And the little boy looked at his dad and said, Daddy, I don't want to be that good. Just like, there it is. And sometimes it's sort of like that. Divine Mother will release us from certain of our sufferings if we would receive that vibration of release, but we don't really want to be that good. It's pleasurable to be resentful. It's pleasurable to be the victim. It's pleasurable to, like, what would be my life be like if I didn't have this to limit me? It's really interesting. As long as I can keep doing this. There's a perverse pleasure in our wrong attitudes. Not even perverse sometimes. Sometimes it's just pure pleasure, our wrong attitudes, but it's perverse compared to what we could be. But receiving the blessings changes our level of consciousness, and then we can't have it anymore. Big deal. Okay. Yes, Jeffrey. It's a misguided pleasure. It's mistaking the small for the large. Yeah. I have a lot of sympathy, though, with the egos. And what I mean to say is, it doesn't go away by just calling the attitude stupid. I spent a lot of my life just calling all my attitudes stupid, and they really didn't help me any. They weren't stupid. I'd spent really a really long time developing them, and I'd put a tremendous amount of thought and energy into it, and they were pretty much as smart as I am. And so just calling them stupid didn't do anything. I had to respect their devious cleverness, and it's worked better since I respect them. They're formidable enemies. You have to really work with them. Yeah.
I find in my own life, I'll hang on to a situation that's negative because it's easier than letting go and changing.
Yeah.
And that, in this one sense, sometimes it feels like I've been in that for a very long time. So yeah. It's a good topic for me.
I call it the preference for the known misery over the effort required to create a new, better reality. I've just watched this. I'm not trying to overdo this, but this interests me so much because I have certain limiting attitudes, and they're mostly like little stinky attitudes about certain things. And I'm just, I don't like them. And I can philosophize like nothing, like nobody's business about how and why I should get over them. And yet I'm just so interested to watch them persevere. You know, they're just really deep-rooted, and there's just been a lot of magnetism built up around them, and they just don't dissolve just for wanting. The difference between intellect and feeling. But, of course, they will dissolve, especially if one does persevere, and some of what we're talking about in here with these essentials on the spiritual path really deal absolutely directly with what I'm talking about, which is how do we really create change? What are the elements that actually transform us? And, you know, we started with right attitudes, and now we're going to go into this next section. Is there anything else to be discussed before we launch? Yes. Okay.
I have a question about blessings. Uh-huh. I've always felt blessed, but in the last 6 months, I've just had so many blessings. And, I mean, I had 2 big ones yesterday and 1 today. And sometimes it's like I'm scared. Like, I can't believe it. God loves me so much. Like, it's sometimes when you receive the blessings, you're almost like, is it that easy? Or I'm just wondering, why would I be scared of all these?
That's a very honest question. Let me just pause for a minute. Well, part of it is the simple fact that we know that when the waves go up, the waves go down. So it's not entirely unwise to realize that if the waves are going to go up, the waves are going to go down. So I don't think the question is, why am I scared? The question is how to stay even-minded. Because to be a little anxious, knowing that I remember once, I don't know what was going on, but things were going really, really well for me. And I sort of whispered to my husband, David, just like, this is a very good period for me, you know? And then sometime it won't be. And then it wasn't. And I said, just remembering, I said the same thing. This is a really horrible time for me. But sometime it won't be. And so I think the way to look at it is, if things are beautiful, it's rude to say they're not. If somebody gives you a really nice present, if somebody gives you a beautiful necklace, but they didn't give you the bracelet, or, you know, you don't say, oh, this is a pretty necklace, where's the bracelet, you know, or anything like that. You just say, oh, how very sweet of you to remember me like this, and your appreciation is genuine. But if you're thinking instead, the necklace, I got the necklace, and your excitement about it is exaggerated, in that very exaggeration, you can feel the fear underneath it. Because if you're not afraid, you don't have to grab so hard and be so. But people think that if they don't grab hard, they're not appreciating. But in fact, we're actually appreciating much deeper when we just sort of see it in its whole proportion. Oh, isn't this wonderful? You know, isn't it just sweet? But we see it more like, it's like it's less personal. I think that's what I really want to say. It's like, oh, something very nice is happening and I get to be part of it. Instead of something really great is happening to me. Because as soon as that me gets in there so strongly, instantly anxiety will come. Because the more we think about ourselves, the more contracted we are and the more nervous we are. The more we see ourselves as part of this bigger flow, the more we don't have to worry so much. Does that make sense to what you're saying? Because even though we do know that when waves go up, they also go down, you don't really want to be saying every time a wave goes up, yes, but it's also going to go down. You know, it's just, it's like, you know it's going to go down, but now it's going up. But if it's not so much about where you are in the cycle, but just everything, this is a very nice period. Let's just sort of enjoy it while it's very nice, and our calm enjoyment of it will make it less of a freak out when it changes. If we're all tense, you know, just the mere fact, if you're tense, you can't shift very easily. Swamiji says you should go. I've only skied a little bit in my life. I came to it late. By the time I couldn't afford it. You know, my early years at Ananda, it was just such a fluke to be able to buy a ticket. But it was totally fun. But I didn't enough to, you know, sort of get, you know, how you kind of have to do this. Or for me, it was do this and then do that. But I just did it a lot. But anyway, but Swamiji talks about skiing. When you ski, you know, you just don't really quite know what's going to come. And so you have to be very centered in yourself. Because if you commit yourself too much one way or another, and then the next mogul or whatever is coming, it's tipping you further that way, you'll fall. But even no matter what they're doing, if you're always centered in yourself, you can just really, you know, you think how exciting it is to ski, if you can do it at all. You go up, you go this way, you have to respond like that. So you have to kind of like have that kind of enjoyment about life. Whoa, look at this, we're really shooting downhill, and then wow, we have just snowplowed right into it. And it's all just part of the party. And then the inevitable is not frightening. You just, well, yeah, of course, this is great, and then tomorrow it won't be. And maybe this whole incarnation will be like that. You never know. Maybe this is the beginning of the next 40-year positive astrological cycle. And maybe it's the end of the last 18 years, you know. You just don't know. Is that fair? Yeah. Okay. That's where even-minded and cheerful comes in. That was the attitudes we were talking about before, quite seriously. Courage, positive thinking at all times, living for God alone, even-minded and cheerful. Okay, we're building something. So what you're describing is you're getting a little too far over on either side. So let's just be even-minded and cheerful, and let's be positive at all times. Let's look at this positively. And the positive way to look at it is, oh, a whole lot more really good things are going to happen, or maybe they won't. And whatever they are, we'll just deal with it. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? All right, great souls. So, we have now actually gone through one section, and we've gone through the attitudes that are necessary for success on the spiritual path. And this one is really interesting, necessities for success on the spiritual path, which he puts out slightly differently. And these are the qualities that we have to cultivate, and we have to cultivate all of them, and there are 11 of them. Okay. And it's very important, because to be a really good devotee, you basically have to become really well-rounded. And that doesn't mean that we won't always have a certain orientation, because two of these are devotion, three of these devotion, will, and determination. Somewhere must be the word discrimination. I have determination, but I don't see the word discrimination, but it must be on there somewhere. Okay, but just being able to tell what's going on with both reason and feeling. And you might be oriented more toward service or more toward meditation, more toward devotion, more toward attunement, more toward study. And so you can basically have a way of being. I mean, I look around this room and I'm looking at several nationalities, several races, ages, body types, so on. And like that, I was just talking this evening about my growing desire to have one of those little Mac air books that basically weigh nothing, because I'm finding I'm just getting old and I'm getting weak, and I travel a lot, and just even that 7-pound or 5-pound computer compared to the 1.5-pound computer has become a really big deal to me. You know, it's just like everything is different. I used to be a young woman. I used to be extremely strong. I used to work in a kitchen. I used to pick up 50-pound boxes of potatoes and carry them up and down stairs. I don't think I could push it with my feet now. I mean, it's just like there's all these different realities that go on, and at different stages of our lives, different things are true. And we have to partly just really realize, well, we have to go with our strengths. This is one of Swami Kriyananda's secrets of success for all of us, is instead of just hammering at your weaknesses, build magnetism with the things you can do. But what's so interesting about this particular section is that there are 11 different points, and you have to really have all of them. There's something I've observed over the years on the spiritual path of really being involved with so many people. So many people, so many different communities at different stages of their spiritual development, different stages of mine. I have a small amount of international experience, not a great deal, but even seeing people from different cultures, if you live here, you see a lot of that. That sometimes we try to avoid having to deal with or develop certain aspects of our nature. We take that idea of going with our strengths a little too far, and we think, because I'm good at this, it gives me license to never have to do that. I never have to face this. I never have to develop that. But in order to become really free, I mean, everything eventually has to come back to harmony. So I think I found it so interesting that he had all of these different qualities here, and that he really wants us to understand each one of them. In fact, he says, memorize this list and repeat it to yourself so that you'll always know. The list is devotion, will. So we go from the heart, but then devotion without power is not going to take us anywhere. If we think about it as the chakras, this is the air element, the heart, and this is where devotion and love emanates from. But the navel center is the fire center. And unless the heart is supported by the fire of the will, it becomes, as Swami says, instead of becoming expansive, it becomes airy-fairy. It just floats around. So a lot of times if we have a very devotional nature, we think, oh, well, that's enough. But the second quality that we have to have is willpower. We have to put willpower behind that, or else we might feel light, but we're not going to go anywhere. So we have devotion, then we have willpower, then he has determination, which is another form of willpower, but just the fact that I'm going to set my mind to this, and I'm really going to make this happen. I'm really determined that this will happen. I've committed myself, because we can use willpower in a completely random manner, you know, be enthusiastic about this, be enthusiastic about that, just shift from one to the other. But that determination that I put my feet on this path and I will not move. Attunement with the guru. And attunement with the guru really is everything, because it all finally comes down to actually following the path you're on. And not just using your devotion to love this saint and then go over to this one and then be all excited about that one and then read this new book and go and buy all these other books. Sooner or later, you have to get in line with the path that you're called to follow, and you have to really you have to use your will and your devotion to put you on that wavelength. Because you don't get out of delusion. You don't break through, as Swami often talks about it. The whole lake is frozen. You don't get through by running from place to place and slapping it with your hands. The only way you can get through that thick layer of ice to the open sea underneath it is you have to chisel down at one point. And you just chisel down through that, and the ice represents all of our delusions. And it's the attunement with the master that actually sort of locks into our consciousness and pulls us through. It's the only way I can think to say it. It's so analogous. Attunement and tuning and being in tune are all also marvelous musical terms. And even though I'm I don't do very much singing, I know what it is when you're on the right note. And I know what it is when somebody's singing with you and you match their note and you really just get with their note. You know immediately this power sets in. And that's symbolic and there to remind us of what it really is to be in tune. Now imagine you have this ray of the infinite coming through your master, and whatever harmony you feel with any human being on this planet is just a shadow of what you can feel when you're in tune with a self-realized master who's come to bring you out of delusion. So just imagine note for note with another person where the power comes from. And attunement with the guru just puts you right on that ray. And then everything just moves. So even devotion, even will, even determination, without corresponding attunement. You have to pay attention and be in tune. The practice of the presence of God. Now, the practice of the presence of God is, what do we do all day, every day? And so we're meditating, so we're reading spiritual books, so we're chanting, but then there's all the rest of the time. You know, what company are we keeping? And at the end of this section, I doubt if we'll get to it today, but Swami just talks about the fact that nobody can change your thoughts but you. And you are simply your thoughts, period. Whatever your thoughts are, that's what you're doing. I mean, it's not what you are on the deepest level, but that's what you're emanating, that's what you're attracting, everything. So when we practice the presence of God, what we're doing is, no, instead of letting our minds just think about this and think about this and worry about that and pre-plan this and regret that and long for this and imagine that, we just keep bringing ourselves back to the right here and now. And right here in this moment, God is as much with me now as he will ever be. And then in every little thing that you see, oh, there's Divine Mother talking to me. Just when you're out exercising, when you're going to the grocery store, just what's around you is saying, oh, look, we got a parking place. Oh, look, we didn't get a parking place. But whatever it is, it's not so much what's happened, is that you're not doing it alone. And if your consciousness is always in the presence of God, you see, then everything comes out just fine. I learned this feeling a lot from having had the opportunity to be with Swami Kriyananda. It's so interesting. It's amazing to me. Because whenever I'm with him, just like I know I'm exactly where I should be. And it has such a ka-ching sort of feeling to it. That's the only word I can use. Where it's just like, boom, you're just right where you should be. And we're walking slowly, we're going somewhere, we're doing nothing. It doesn't make any difference. Because in his presence, my consciousness is uplifted to the point where I just remember, just be here now, it's okay. And because there is no desire to be anywhere else, I get to experience what it feels like to not desire to be somewhere else. So it's not just being in his company, but it's experiencing in myself what it feels like to just be right where you are. And know that the divine is with you and you're fine. Do you understand what I mean? That's one of the reasons why one moment in the company of the saint can be your raft over the ocean of delusion. Because once you see where you're going and actually experience where you're trying to go, for one thing, you have a constant point of reference. Even if you don't remember it, even if it's just planted in your chakras and you go incarnations without a conscious awareness of it, even on a subconscious level, it's always your reference point. That's where Edgar Cayce, in his readings of people, often said to them, you were in Jerusalem. He did these life readings for people, and he would tell them things. He was a seer. He would go into a trance. I mean, he lived about 40 or 50 years ago now, maybe even more. But he would go into trance, and he would read people's incarnations. And for many people, he said, you were on the street. Jesus walked by. And for the last 2,000 years, you've been integrating that experience. Amazing, isn't it? One moment in the company of the saint, and in the presence of Jesus, the vibration was so strong that for one moment of whatever long that lasted, you locked into where you were trying to go. And it told you where you were trying to go. And then after that, for all these other lives, one keeps looking and looking and looking, but you're anchored at that point. Amazing, practicing the presence. And then he says, following the rules. And he later on we'll talk about this, but it's very interesting. He talks about how the life that Master designed for us is very balanced. I know sometimes people would come into Ananda and they would come into Ananda with, this is what I do and this is how I do it and this is what I eat and this is when I eat it and this is when I get up and this is when I do that. And I just remember trying to say to this guy, it's like, just like experiment, like go with the program. You know, just go with the program. See what happens when you just go with the program. Because Master has really designed a very balanced life for us. And sometimes we think that we know better, but we don't necessarily know better. Because we tend to sort of lean in the direction we're already leaning. I'm so amused by that. I early on to Swamiji, when I was so mental, He said the reason I couldn't cook is I was so mental, I couldn't taste the food. I mean, when I first started cooking, I couldn't cook. He had to teach me how to cook. But he said that later, he said that. He said, you were so mental, you couldn't even taste the food. I mean, I don't know exactly what that meant, but I just couldn't get into my body, into life enough to just know whether food tasted good or not. But I said to him at that point, because, you know, things weren't going the way I thought they should. So if you're doing something that's not working, just do more of it. You know, that's how the brain works. Because it's what you know. And if you're inclined to doubt yourself, you'll just think, well, whatever I'm doing, I'm just not doing it well enough. So I said to Swamiji, he was sitting in this armchair, as I recall it. This was like, must have been June of 71. That's my excuse. I must have been there about 2 weeks. At least it was June, July, or August. It was that first summer. I said, sir, I really think I need to improve my power of analysis. I actually said those words. My memory, which is probably false, but this is how it felt to me. He was sitting in this armchair, and the impression I had was that he went, no, like that. In truth, he's not reactive, so I doubt if he actually rose from his chair and reached out. But I think his aura just went out to me. And he said quite emphatically, no, just like that. And it was like, it wasn't merely that he wanted to say no to me. He wanted to eat those words, just get them completely out of the ether and just throw them down. No, he said very forcefully. And then sort of more quietly, he said, develop devotion. Because no, the reason it's not working is because it's not going to work, no matter how much of it you do. That's why we need other people to help us, because we just go down the track that we're going and think the only thing wrong is we're not doing enough of it. People who are tight and rigid think they should fast more. You know, take one more thing out of their diet. You know, I think if I can just stop eating eggs and if I can just only have two meals a day or reduce my sleep. No, just develop devotion. Just relax, relax. Practice the presence of God. Or people say, you know, I need to just flow more. No, you need to have a discipline. You need to have a little will. Okay. Then number 7, regular meditation and practice of the techniques, which is interesting. Not merely to meditate, but to meditate in the way that Master taught us. Because, you know, we just don't know where these doors lead. It's one of those things. It's like you start playing the guitar and you think you can figure out how to hold it and I can do it like this and it'll work. And you don't realize until you're well into it that you've twisted yourself and you're never going to get where you're trying to get. So you have to not only meditate, but you have to meditate according to the way we've been taught, because this is the path we're on. Duh. But really, sometimes it's surprising how, even though we profess all this devotion and respect, how casually we just do a little of this and a little of that and a little of this and a little of that, and we don't have the foggiest idea what we're doing. A little humility is helpful. Willingness, which is just the difference between will and willingness. You know, will is that strong, focused energy, but willingness is just being there, having a positive attitude. Just like, let's try it. Let's see what happens. Let's, you know, sometimes you see it in children. They're just so unwilling. No. 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 You know, okay, we're going to go to the store and it's going to be really fun. No! One of my friends, her fourth child, was what they call a contrarian. Really didn't make any difference what she said. Whatever it was, he was the opposite. Period. There's a wonderful story that a friend of mine used to tell. He was a school administrator, and he said, and this is a true story, there was this family somewhere in Texas, and they had three children, sort of relatively close in age, and they were just a model family, you know. And even as they got to be teenagers, they were just such a harmonious group, and they did spring cleaning together, you know. It was just like a great family. And so the parents started giving classes in parenting, and it was all so fabulous. And when the youngest was a young teenager, they had what people lovingly call an oops baby, you know, which is just like, oh, look, there's one more. We didn't really know this. And so then this baby comes out, and this is the truth. The parents who continued to give parenting seminars said the first word this child said was no. And the child's first complete sentence was, do it yourself. And they realize it's not all a matter of your technique. It also depends on who you got in the luck of the draw there. But such a person has to be treated very differently, but you don't want to be that kind of devotee. You don't want to be the kind of devotee where everything has to be dragged out of you. You want to be at the front of the line. Just, oh, that's a good idea, let's try it. You know, just moving out there with willingness. And then it talks about enthusiasm for the work. And this is another one of those common misunderstandings. Well, I'm just here to meditate. I'm just here to be in tune with God. But again, on this path, and bear in mind, this is a class that Swamiji wrote for disciples who had come to be disciples of Master and were living in that ashram. And there are characteristics of this particular spiritual path. And of course, everybody has different roles in it. I remember this when Swamiji was in the late 70s and at Ananda Village, we had been sort of living this relatively isolated life in this idyllic setting. It was when Swami and I were talking about, you know, what would cause you to have to reincarnate again. And he gave me that phrase, which I think I shared with you, where he said, what the karma that holds you is anything you think of with longing or with regret. And that's the karma that you have to reincarnate for. Those unfulfilled desires will bring you back, or the sense of shame and guilt. If only I could have done it differently. Both of those things tie you equally. So when he was talking to me about this, I thought for a moment and I said, well, those first 10 years at Ananda were heaven on earth. And he said, well, that's a little different. You know, that's just a joyous enthusiasm for something that was in the past. I don't live in those years. But in those first years when we lived at Ananda Village and we were just sort of pulling our world together, we just had so much fun. And we had very little interaction. We weren't completely isolated, but we enjoyed our world without having to adapt it very much to others. And then we were done, and Swamiji started a movement to reach out more and do more missionary work and starting centers and splitting the family up geographically and, you know, all sorts of things that happened after. And one woman wrote, she said, Swamiji, I just have no attunement with going to live in a center or trying to introduce new people to these teachings. You know, I love this path, but to me it's living this quiet life and meditating and, you know, taking care of what I need to do. And he answered back by saying, well, somebody has to do that. We can't have everybody go out and talk about this community if somebody isn't here living in it. You know, it's like everybody has a different role. So it's not like everybody has to be the same. But Master is an avatar who came to shift from Kali Yuga into Dwapara, and we can't just pretend that that's not important. We can't just say, well, I'm not interested. Just like Swami is often quoting Dayamata when he asked her, when are we going to start these communities that Master talked about so enthusiastically? And she said, well, I'm not interested. We can't be like that because it violates being attunement with the Guru. And also, it is not the vibration of this ray. The vibration of this ray is tremendous concern for the world. It's the nature of this path. There can be true paths, which are hermit paths, or different stages, you know, of this avatar, where we just get to go and live in a very isolated way, or very periods of time. But we have to have a lot of enthusiasm for what Master is trying to accomplish. We can support that from solitude just with prayer. It's not like, as I was saying, it's not like everybody has to do the same thing, but we have to be very enthusiastic about the work that's given to us to do, and that also means the work that the Master came to do. But then he adds in here, without personal ambition. And elsewhere he puts this, you'd be very ambitious for the success of the cause. You know, if a person is ambitious, they work hard, they discipline themselves, they use their will, they sacrifice, they're focused, they're creative, all these different things, if you're trying to get wealthy or get worldly recognition. And we have to have that much determination, but the determination is for this ambitious for what we can do for others. And not even institutional ego in there, but that's more of a refinement of what it means. But great enthusiasm for the work. I remember myself when that thought really crossed my mind. I've shared some with some of you, but I'll say it again here. I was very proud of the fact that my only interest in being at Ananda was in order to be close to Swami Kriyananda and learn from him. And that was the truth, but there was pride in that thought, which is they're all, you know, he's building this community and they're all trying to make this community and do all that, but I'm just here to learn from him. And I was riding in the back seat of the car, and we were driving through Ananda, and I was sort of looking out the window at the, this was all in that first decade, I was looking out the window at just the tremendous effort required to turn that just absolute bare land into the beautiful place it is now. And I thought how much, just how much work it was. And I was conscious of the commitment of energy that Swami Kriyananda himself was putting into making that thing work. And it just crossed my mind that, you know, I'm perfectly willing to take from him, but I'm not willing to give to what he's giving to. And I thought, that's not the act of a friend. If you're friends with someone, you help them. You help them do what's important to them, even if it's not that important to you. But you do it because it's important to be a friend. And I just suddenly saw how misguided my thinking was. And so that's part of attunement, that's part of following the rules and living the balanced life that's given to us. But it's also having great enthusiasm for the work that we do. You know, the work that we do for God, or the work that you do, whatever work you do, because that enthusiastic, positive energy for what you can contribute is a salient characteristic of this path. So if you're not able to be there, then you have to find a way to bring your attitudes around to it, or else it will put you out of tune. Overcoming your moods, being even-minded. You know, people, we all have this habit of indulging our moods. It's really so vitally important, because otherwise, Master said, when you're moody, Satan has a hold of you. In other words, you have to fight the good fight. You can't just... I was struck. The school that we have here, our Living Wisdom School for Children, you know, has a really marvelous philosophy of educating children and what it means to be an integrated good adult. And a lot of schools in the area sort of are picking up the self-esteem and self-worth kind of theme, but without the understanding that the path of self-realization gives you, sometimes you kind of miss the boat a little bit. And once I took a field trip with some of the teachers here to one of the really extremely posh private schools in the area that's considered to be one of the very best, and we were there, and there was a self-esteem tree that they had on a bulletin board, and I don't know, the kids were maybe fourth or fifth grade, and every child had put a leaf on the tree about something that gave them self-esteem. And every single one of those leaves, except one, was about an external accomplishment. My soccer team won, I got an A on my test, I was chosen first, I got the lead in the play, and then one person, one leaf, said, I'm not as moody as I used to be. But I thought, you know, there you have it. You're just setting yourself up to crash again, because waves go up and waves go down. They were building self-esteem, and that was the nature of the school, because it's like you have to be juried into the school. You know, you have to meet a certain standard. Okay, so I'm terrific and outstanding in everything I can accomplish. But who am I? You know, so... Swami puts right here, you have to overcome your moods. You have to get mastery over your own inner energy. You can't just let your energy run. You can't let yourself fall into negativity or to cynicism or despair or any of those things. We when we get into them, as Swamiji said, the nature of delusion is that it convinces you you have to relate to it. So you get into this delusion that, oh, I'm depressed, so you have to think about being depressed, or I feel victimized, so you have to think about being victimized. And Swamiji said once a cold started coming into him. He felt the cold enter. And as soon as he felt the cold coming into him, he felt the cold demanding that he relate to it and think, oh, I feel a little bad now. Oh my, I guess I'm going to have to rest for a few days. And he just said, I don't even have to relate to this cold. And in a very loud voice, he said, get out, like that. And it just drove it away, just like that. Because it was the delusion itself that said he had to relate to it. And you know, moodiness, the nature of them is they grab us and they persuade us that I have to stop and think about this. I remember a woman friend, Swamiji had her working like 7 days a week. And another friend said, you know, I think you should tell her to take a day off. And Swami looked at the friend who was making the suggestion. He said, I know what she needs, just like that. Because that friend had a very strong tendency to be moody. And as soon as they were left without something to do, they didn't rise into a great experience of God. They sank into a period of self-preoccupation and worry. So the key was to just stay busy. You know, so you can't allow all those little feelings to just dominate you. That will really take you off the path. See, all of these things are, you have to, and one of the things that, one mood is self-concern over your own spiritual progress. That's also a mood, you know, that, oh, now I'm all worried about my spiritual progress, and that one really persuades you that you have to relate to it. That it's actually a good idea to relate to that. But if I don't worry about my spiritual progress, how will I make any? By forgetting yourself. And then always trying to overcome the lower qualities in one's nature and to embrace the higher ones. I love the way he puts that, because he doesn't say overcoming the lower qualities. He says always trying to overcome. It's a very subtle difference between that. Which is that even though whoever we are, whatever we are, Swami made a comment recently. He was talking about being expelled from Self-Realization Fellowship in 1962. He mentions that often when he's giving his LA satsangs. And he said, they said they expelled him because of his ego, he said, which of course in itself was fallacious. But he said, even if he was just terribly troubled with ego, that's not a reason for throwing a person out of a spiritual work. It's just the opposite. It's like, this person has a real ego problem. We need to help them, you know? And so that's how we have to be able to constantly think about our own difficulties. Well, I have a really big problem this way, so that means I have to keep trying. It doesn't disqualify us from spiritual work, you see? It actually qualifies us for spiritual work. Once I was thinking about just how many difficulties people have in the context of our spiritual ashram. And I think, well, who did you think was going to come? There's a story, supposedly true, of Oliver Black, who was one of Master's most advanced male disciples. And he ran a meditation group and eventually built a community in Michigan. And once apparently Oliver complained to Master, Master, all I'm getting is the halt, the blind, and the lame. And Master apparently looked at him and said, Oliver, they're your people. Just like that. Sister Durga Mata, who lived at Mount Washington, she had Durga's kids, is what they called them. And Durga Mata lived at Mount Washington, but kind of had her own life and ministry. She had the apartment that Rajasi had built at Mount Washington, and it had its own staircase up, and she just lived separate from what was going on at SRF and had her own disciples and her own band, and they were Durga's kids, they called themselves. And after Durga Mata died, this one woman was working with us, and she said, Durga just had a way with people who were just like one bubble off, you know, just a little bit, people who just didn't relate to this world all that easily. She put herself in that category. That was her ministry. You know, those are the people that she helped. You know, we sort of think that if you're on the spiritual path, you're a shining example of perfection. But people for whom everything works don't usually come onto the spiritual path because everything is working. I mean, there can be a memory of it. When I asked Swamiji that, I said, I have such an intense desire to be happy and to avoid suffering, but nothing bad has ever even happened to me. Asha, he looked at me, previous lives, you know, you have karmic memories. So even if you're in a cycle where the waves are mostly up, you still know that waves go down. You're just born knowing that. And it's a powerful incentive. But of course, many people who get on the spiritual path struggle in this world. And then struggle on the path. Of course, that's why we're here. That's why he says, always trying. Never giving up. Just always trying. And even remembering, that's why it's phrased, always trying to overcome the lower qualities and embrace the higher qualities. That's all you have to do. There is no other standard. There's no measurement. All you have to do is be trying. That's all that the Guru ever asks of us. All right, let's take a moment's break here before we go on with this. So, let's go on. Any thoughts or, are we ready? Any comments or thoughts or questions before we go forward? So, Swami Niji, now what we do in these lessons is we're going to go over each one of these, and of course he spends a great deal of time on the subject of devotion. So that's where we're going to start, because it is the first one. And he says quite simply that, of course, it is the most important quality on the path. But because unless we can get the heart engaged, we don't have any motivation at all. As Swamiji often puts it, you know, you can know about all the good restaurants in town, but unless you're hungry, you'll never do anything about it. And that also is a distinguishing quality about people who are interested in the path and people who are on the path, is that at some point there's a part of you that really longs for this, and that you're moved by love. And Sri Yukteswar, even in his book The Holy Science, which, you know, Sri Yukteswar is known for being such a jnana, but at the end of that whole book he says, so I hope that I've persuaded you that the one essential on the path is love, meaning that your feelings have to be engaged. And because the heart has a wisdom, that the mind, that reason alone, you can't really understand things by reason alone. There has to be some intuitive connection with it, because there's so many factors on the spiritual path that you just can't logic them out. Now, what I love about Master's Path overall, and what I love about the way Swami Kriyananda has articulated it, he said, you can reason out an awful lot of it. You know, he rarely, and only in very extreme cases, just sort of says you have to wait to get an answer to that. When I asked Swamiji some questions once about the whole thing that Master talks about, how for Jesus, John the Baptist was really his guru, and then Master has talked sometimes about that Babaji is really Master's guru, and Sri Yukteswar was just sent to train him, and I sort of asked Swamiji these questions sort of over breakfast one morning when he was in our house. I just asked him, you know, like, what is all of this about? Why is it like this? And he just shrugged his shoulders like that. And then to that question and once or twice to others, he said, a few mysteries just have to wait. We'll just have to find out later. But very rarely, most of the time, you can even reason it out. And even more recently, the question, why did God manifest the universe? Swamiji has come up with this beautiful answer. It's the nature of joy to want to share itself. And he just gives the simple example that if you go to a movie that you really like, you tell your friends, don't you? It's not sufficient. When you feel that expanding sense of happiness, the first thing you want to do is tell someone about it, isn't it? And he said, the infinite consciousness living in this state of bliss wanted to expand that bliss and share its joy with others. It's such a, even though you still can't quite comprehend it, you've been given a little piece of it. But a great deal of the spiritual path, you just sort of know it from your heart. You can reason out whether this is your path or not, whether this is the ashram you should follow, whether this is a technique that's going to work for you, whether Master is your guru, whether any of these things are true. And you can use your mind a lot on those things, but there's a certain point where you feel it. And it's also that strong feeling energy is what allows you to endure a lot of things. I mean, think of it like this. You know, think how parents feel about their children. Where I go swimming at the YMCA, the time that I swim is usually, I try to make it just before, but sometimes it overlaps with this, what they call the little splashers, which is adults bringing very small people in. You know, sometimes really tiny people, but lots of small people. Grandparents, parents, nannies, fathers, mothers, they bring their little splashers in and they all sort of play in the water and they try to get these little tiny kids happy swimming in the pool. And they sing and they just, I love it. It's just darling to watch it. But you see all these parents, you know, with their own child, and they just love their child. You know, and there's some of that you are clearly adopted children because they're different races than, totally different races, not just mixed races, but totally different races than the parent who's holding them. But, you know, it doesn't matter where that baby came from. They just love that baby so much. And knowing what it really takes to raise a child, you know that if there wasn't that heartfelt commitment, you just would never do it. It is way too much trouble, way too much sacrifice, way over the top, too much money, everything. But because there's that feeling energy, that devotion. You know, the word devotion also means devoted. And it's a very important aspect of the word devotion, because when you become devoted to something, you know, there's many levels of you that's doing that. We become devoted to God. And so when we develop devotion, we're developing an attitude of being really devoted to this. When you're devoted to someone, you know, you talk about he's really devoted to his wife. And what that means is he honors her, he respects her, he loves her, he does what she, you know, what helps her. And so all of these qualities make it possible for everything else to follow. Will, willingness, determination, it all comes because the feelings are engaged. And even though some people like to think of themselves, you know, I'm more gyanic, people will say, or something like that, it really doesn't serve you to sort of resist the involvement of the heart. People resist the involvement of the heart either because they're afraid of it leaping, often because they're afraid of it sort of getting out of control. And that's one of the reasons that Master puts all these qualities together, that you have to have discrimination and willpower also. But the single most important quality is that you have to care. And that you have to, and the more you can cultivate that, just like I was talking to a mother recently, and I was actually trying to get her to understand my devotion to the spiritual path, which she sort of was a little suspicious of in a certain way. And I said, do you love your children? She sort of wondered why I was asking such a thing. Of course I love my children. I said, did you really have to, you know, why do you love your children? She said, well, just from the first instant. I said, it was an experience, right? You had an experience of loving those children, and it became who you are. And I said, there are mothers, and you probably know some, who consider their children a burden. And, you know, yes, there's some people think their children are a burden because they haven't had that experience of what it means to be devoted to them and how expansive it is. And because it's a lot of work. And children are cute, but they can be really annoying. And they're fundamentally barbarians. And if adults behaved like children, they would be in lunatic asylums. You know, it's you can be very romantic about it, but the fact of the matter is, it's not all roses by any means. There's a lot involved there. But because of the devotion of the heart, you can just do it. Now, raising yourself from infancy to sainthood is even harder, because we're never cute, you know, like they are. But if we have that extreme devotion, and what our devotion is our devotion is to light, our devotion is to bliss, our devotion is to the relationship, however it comes out. But we need all the help we can get. And that's why in this section too, which we're not going to get through tonight, but Swami gives us so many different things we can do just to get that heart energy going. And he puts it first, and he spends so much time on it, because if you can get that heart energy going, it'll pull the whole wagon. That's why it's the single most important quality. It can't be the only quality, because devotion must be kept in a state of reason, as Master called it, or else it can be misguided or it can become fanatical. But it still has to be there, because everything else will follow. If you love something, you don't have to discipline yourself to do it. I mean, whoa, there's a chocolate cake in the kitchen. Oh, I guess I'll just have to eat it. You know, it's not like it's a great willpower thing to eat it. You just rush over there and say, is this mine? You know, is this for me? I was watching this little child. I was just speaking of children. This is sort of slightly unrelated, but, you know, it's easy to project onto children. This little girl was sitting on her mother's lap. She was about two. I was watching her. And she was singing, Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. And she was just this little tiny lisping thing. Sri Ram, Jai Ram. And then somebody came with her bottle, and she says, mine, 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 mine. Just without missing a beat. So, anyway, going on. Doesn't really have any relevance, but I was just watching. So let me go back here. With children, yeah. Or with us? Yes. Exactly. In fact, one of my favorite chants is, Lord, this is mine, this is mine. One of my favorite quotes from the Festival of Light is, what else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? Which, of course, is a rhetorical question answered in the negative, but still, it's in there. So we often joke about that one, that you're asked to share. But yes, exactly. But what brings you back again and again is love. And Swami Kriyananda, in his book, The Path, talks about that period of time after he wasn't very long on the path, when he just went through this intense period of doubt. And Master had taken him out to 29 Palms to work on editing. And Master was, and there were other monks there, and all the monks who were there were just invited over to Master's house to be with him and spend time with him. And Swami was just left alone, you know, for hours and hours every day doing this job that he was unqualified to do, and just being tortured by doubts. As he put it, he felt that he was, you know, that all of these forces were just fighting on both sides, you know, faith and doubt, and he was just caught in the middle and just being pummeled. And he said it went on for about 3 months, in which he just could hardly function because of that. And then he said, finally, he began to doubt Master's wisdom. He began to doubt what Master said. It was just torn up. And he said, what finally ended it, though, interestingly, he said, was no intellectual resolution. As it happened, his parents came to visit, and Master gave him permission to spend a day or two with them. And he was with his parents, who were horrified by the life choices he'd made and didn't appreciate anything that he was doing. But underneath it, Swami realized how much they loved each other. And then he suddenly turned back to Master and realized that all the things that were going around in his mind just really weren't the issue. He loved Master, and he knew Master loved him. And that love was what drew them together, not anything else. And he said, and that's how the whole thing resolved. And that is, on the spiritual path, if you profoundly and deeply cultivate a love for it. And that's why, you know, I don't really like it when people criticize their own path, even a little bit, or think of parts of it as icky. Or, you know, such and so. Sometimes people will say, oh yeah, you take Kriya and then all this karma comes up. And I just don't like anything that orients you in a negative way toward it. You know, one needs to love your spiritual path wholeheartedly, every part of it. Because it's not that easy to stay on the path and make it through to the end. And above all, you want to have cultivated this deep and loving relationship with it. And a loving relationship with all the people. Also, it's another part that's important, is these are my brothers and sisters. I can't leave them. I can't even think of it. How could I imagine a life without them? Once, when I was trying to just, you know, sort of play with not being afraid of possibilities, what would happen, you know, if I got thrown out of Ananda or got completely separated? Once, when I flew to India by myself, I flew Asiana Airlines, and it stopped in Seoul, South Korea. And it was a very good connection, very nice airport. Really good restaurant, which I can tell you about if you ever have to stop in Seoul, South Korea. But it was like 4 or 5 hours. I think this was when Swami had just moved to India and I went by myself. And it may have been the first time I'd ever taken such a long trip by myself, I don't know. But there I was in South Korea in this airport, not leaving the airport, but about 4 hours layover or something like that. And I started playing through this. What if war breaks out? You know, what if something happens? What if my passport is lost? Well, that would be a small thing, but like, what if something happens and I'm stuck here and I just can never get out of Korea, South Korea, and I have to spend the next 15 years in South Korea? You know, these things sort of happen and I'm like completely away from everyone, what would I do? I would say I would start trying to recreate it. That's what I do. You know, I just start looking for my spiritual brothers and sisters and try to make another Ananda here. Because this is who we are. This is what we're devoted to. You know, and it's fun like that. Am I really devoted to this, or is this just a habit? If it were all taken away from me, what would I do then? Shivani, who used to a lot, she would try to think about the worst possibilities and not be afraid of them. And it was sort of a joke. This was an Ananda joke. Swami Kriyananda's house, as most of you all know, is on the other side of the hill from the main community. And now there's a paved road, and in fact, there's a paved road that actually goes straight over the hill. Before, the road was unpaved, and it went way around the hill, and it was a much longer ride to get there. And most of us didn't have cars anyway, and we used to have to walk from the main farm area over essentially where the road goes, but you have to walk through the woods. And there were no telephones, no email, no fax, none of that. In those days, there was no electricity in a lot of places for that matter, but there was just, there wasn't a power to most places. Now it's all been fixed up. So you would like get a message, Swami wants to see you, come over at 4 or something like that, and the message would just reach you in some way or another. And then you would have to walk that whole distance over the hill over to his house. And if he had just invited you over without telling you why, you got to walk that whole distance and wonder why he'd called you. And Shivani talked about having been summoned, which is not really invited, it's probably the better word, and just sort of preparing herself for the worst, you know, imagining that, he just finally realized that she was just unsuitable. She was really never going to make it on the spiritual path, and let's just cut our losses now and not waste any more time. You know, and then how would she respond when he said that to her? And then after it was decided that she had to leave, where would she go? What would she do? You know, just sort of, and just sort of coming to an acceptance and realizing how she was going to carry on, even if he kicked her out. Of course, by the time she got there, he wanted her to take a job or something like that. It was none of that. But, you know, just practicing that, regardless of what happens, this is mine. I mean, think of Swami's own life. I've heard the story of him being kicked out of SRF so many different times. Just, I've heard it over and over again, and every so often I hear it again. He was living in India. He was summoned by Dayamata and Taramata to New York City, you know, 3,000 miles from where he actually lived in America, 3,000 miles from everything that he knew in America, which was Los Angeles. They kicked him out of SRF, forbade him ever to contact anybody, left him with about $500, and I just really realized they just abandoned him in New York with like $500. He was in a hotel. He had one night in a hotel. I mean, what was he supposed to do? I mean, just think about that. For some reason, I never actually comprehended that till this morning, because his parents arrived from Europe and he immediately got in the car. They were in New York, Scarsdale. He got in the car. He came to California. But that was not pre-planned. They just left. They flew out. They flew from New York to Los Angeles, just left him there without any idea what was going to happen next. But his love for Master was so strong that didn't matter. All these things could happen, and that was never changed. That's like a mother's love for her child, a father's love for her child. You know, the child can become a murderer, and the mother could still love the child because that love is stronger than any other conditions. And that's how we have to get on the spiritual path. And going back to what we were talking about when we came in, constantly receiving the blessings, constantly affirming and understanding that God is really always with me, receiving the love that's coming. Because, of course, being loved is a very powerful incentive to love back, isn't it? Partly because in the experience of being loved, appreciation, gratitude, an awareness of unity, a sense of value, all begins to come. Now, it's not enough. We can't just love God because he's so generous to us. But what we're really receiving is the experience of being in that vibration of love. Because we're always in it. We're always, at all times. And these are, again, these are concepts that we hear about all the time. We are that consciousness. It's not like we become it, or God so generously allows us a peek. You know, here's a crumb off of the big cheesecake of life. You know, here's a little tiny piece for you. That's not true at all. We are that consciousness, and what we do is we move in and out of the awareness of it. But the I-thou devotional relationship helps us to move into the awareness of it. When we personify it and personalize it and talk about Divine Mother loving us, it gives us a way to understand. That's why in the Bible, which is such a beautiful phrase, Jesus called it the Comforter. I love that. You've heard the little Sunday school one, the little kid comes home and says, "Don't worry, Mommy, God is going to send us the quilt." But it's an amazing word, Comforter, isn't it? And when, you know, Jesus wasn't able to talk that much about God as the Divine Mother because the times in which he lived just didn't make it possible. But what was he saying when he said God would send you the Comforter? Isn't Comforter the essence of the Mother? I mean, that's how you think about the Mother, isn't it? You curl up on your mother's lap. I remember when I was 7, my mother sent me to sleepaway camp. And I mostly did really well, except I was the youngest child there, and I couldn't quite do everything. I was fine. I don't remember being homesick or anything. But they made these little pot holders, you know, the elastic things. You had this little thing, and you put them, this little warp and woof, and you put these little elastic things, and you have these little pot holders. I don't know, my little hands, I guess, just couldn't do it. So everybody had made pot holders, and they hung them on their bunks. And it was Parents' Day, Parents' Weekend, and all the parents came, and I didn't have any pot holders because I just hadn't been able to make them. So this girl named Rainey was her name. She had the bunk above me, and she had several, so I took several of hers and hung them on mine. The 7-year-old brain, you know, like, why do I think that was a good idea? But I didn't have any pot holders. And then, of course, she noticed that I'd taken her pot holders, and she wasn't pleased. So there was a little bit of a scene, and I don't usually lie, but I guess I was just so upset. I said, they fell. I tried to persuade them. And my parents didn't scold me for lying, so I guess they were, but I really remember crawling into my mother's, I almost cry thinking about it. I really remember crawling into my mother's lap, and I was so distraught by it, and I just remember her holding me, you know? Imagine, that's the Comforter. You know, everything in the moment was so tragic. It was so trivial, but it was so tragic to me. It's still a little bit of a trauma, odd. But she comforted me. And how can you not love that? How can you not just be craving that at all times? And that was Jesus' promise. God will send you the Comforter. And with our devotion, we can receive that. One of the reasons my mother could hold me, one of the reasons I crawled into her lap, is because there was that love between us that made her able to comfort me and me desirous of her comfort. My, my, my. All right. I think that will serve us. So let devotion be your theme for this week, and I won't forget it. Just keep it in your mind and see how devotion can serve you. We're just touching the surface of it, so we'll be doing this for a while. All right, great souls, that will be enough for tonight. God bless you.